countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our marked price calculator on farmersjournal.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, Brenda Dunahoo meets Orla McAlinden to talk about farming and writing. Suzanne Campbell meets some chocolate makers, and we learn what a cludog is. But first, Magners Farm in County Tipperary is home to a pasture-fed flock of 1,000 laying hens. Kylie Magner and her husband Billy started the egg enterprise 4 years ago with 10 hens. The business has grown and diversified, and this year achieved organic certification. I took a trip to Tip to meet Kylie and go to a hen party with a difference. But as I arrived, she was more concerned about her sheep.
Marty.
How are you, Kylie?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
You are absolutely weighed down with seed and with hay. Kylie Magner, you're working hard at this hour of the morning.
Yeah, that's right, Marty. I guess it's kind of a long hours in farming, early mornings and late nights.
It's all part of it. And I love your beautiful Tipperary accent, Kylie.
Yes, a little bit further south than Tipperary. I'm originally from central west New South Wales at a place called Orange, New South Wales.
So from Orange to Feathered, just outside Feathered in County Tipperary, that's a long way.
It is. I originally came here in 1998. And I was really lucky to probably get my dream job in the first week I arrived here. And I was working for Coolmore Stud and the advertising and marketing department. And then met my husband, Billy, about 6 months later. So what started out as a working holiday turned into marriage and 4 children.
Wow, some story.
Yeah.
Love story begins in Feathered.
In McCarthy's pub, yeah. Where all true romances begin.
So McCarthy's is the real centre of romance.
Well, it used to be, yeah. Probably, I don't know what people are doing these days now that it's shut, but yeah, definitely used to be. I'm just going to bring this up. We've got some ewes that have lambed, and I just want to bring their babies.
Can I bring that for you?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, one sec. Now,
it's really
there's no point being here just to try to be a reporter when I can do a bit of work.
Yeah, climbing. Yeah. Put you to use. I'll
so
put you
where are we going? Through the farm? Okay, yeah. Through the land. Okay, cool.
Mind your
okay.
There.
Yeah, you want a good pair of Wellingtons on.
We've only 17 sheep.
Right.
But they've all either got lambs on them or they're about to have lambs. So, yeah, it's a beautiful time of year.
Yes, that's seasoned.
It is the spring. We'll just open up this gate here. Come on, ladies.
Big difference between the sheep and the hens, though.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose, though, the sheep fit really nicely into our farming system. We're trying to have a few different varieties of animals and enterprises on our farm. They break the parasite cycle between each other. The sheep bring the grass down nice and short for the hens, and then the hens will clean up any sort of parasites that the sheep might be carrying. So they work really well together.
Absolutely. Now, where are the hens?
Let's go and find them.
Okay.
Come on, I'll bring you in here.
Cool.
Yeah.
So how many hens do you have here now?
So we have around 1,000 hens at the moment on the farm. If they were laying well, we should be up around about 850 eggs to 900 eggs per day. Our hens are probably a little slow at the moment because they have just come out of winter. They're probably laying quite a bit less than that at the moment, but by the time summer and spring kicks in, they'll be well and truly hitting 850, 900 eggs a day.
So when you have 1,000 hens, as you have here, do you know each one? I mean, when you have 10, you probably know their names almost and their personalities.
Yeah, so we have 4 different flocks that make up that 1,000. And, you know, it might sound funny to say that I know them, but I know each flock and I know their idiosyncrasies. And definitely within each flock, there are certain hens that you get to know because they're particularly friendly or they'll, you know, have a specific physical feature that you might recognise. Last year during COVID, there was a shortage of laying hens, and we invested in an incubator and we started hatching our own hens. And we ended up breeding quite a few hens that are now laying really unusual coloured eggs. So they're laying greens and blues and pinks and whites. So we would really know those hens because they're quite special.
Is there a market for those different coloured eggs?
Well, you would think it might be something just specific for Easter that people would love those type of eggs. But there are some people who really love ordering them every week. We do sell those in a specific box, rainbow eggs, we call those.
This past year must have been very different. In terms of COVID, what impact did that have on your business?
Well, literally overnight, we lost half of our market. So we were selling into cafes and restaurants who were probably buying close to 50% of our eggs. And luckily for us, I'd like to say it was a stroke of business genius, but but luckily for us, people were staying at home and they were baking and they were cooking. And it almost went from having a surplus of eggs to not having enough eggs. And we found that there were lots of people coming to the farm and buying from our hut. COVID just made us realise how necessary it is to have local food producers. And it's been really wonderful to get to know our community, you know, as they kind of start looking for locally produced food.
And was it an accident you got into hens, or was it always part of your own plan and knowledge?
Not really. I suppose I grew up on a farm, so we always had hens around the place. But I think here on the farm, because we're in such a horse-based area, there are so many other people doing horses. So we were really looking for an agricultural enterprise that could have a cash flow fairly immediately. And also an animal or a bird or an enterprise that our children could be involved in. We kind of thought, you know, sheep and cattle are great, but if there's an accident or a child is, you know, around them, it can be dangerous. And we're too small really for tillage. So hens seemed like a really good enterprise. There was a lot of research and time went into planning the business, but we really just started with the 10 and then up to 50 and then 150. And then in the last 3 years, we've built up to 1,000 hens that we have now.
Saturday morning, it's the day you go to market.
That's right. And Saturday morning for us is market day in Care. So we take our eggs over to Contrast's apple farm stall and they sell them at their stall for us. But it kind of was where we started out when we first started with our farm. And the first morning I remember we went was a really cold November morning and we had 6 dozen eggs in the back of the car. And we were looking at each other thinking, what are we going to do with all these eggs? You know, what if nobody buys them? But luckily they did. And, you know, I think we send over 20 dozen eggs every Saturday morning now. So, times have changed. But it's still a really special place. And the people that you meet through the markets, not just the other people who are in the markets, but the people who come to the markets. It's a really special place.
And that was Kylie Magner and her patient flock of hens waiting to go to pasture. And I know Kylie is usually on her way around this time to the farmer's market at Care. So good morning, Kylie, and good morning to all the stall holders there. By the way, the market in Care in the shadow of the castle is just fantastic. So you should visit them if you're anywhere near Care in County Tipperary on a Saturday morning. Now, I am sure you're looking forward to a bit of Easter egg tomorrow. Our generation loves chocolate eggs, but go back a generation or two and families will be looking forward to a feast of hen, duck or even goose eggs tomorrow. Shane Lahan is interested in our folklore and teaches a course in Cultural and Heritage Studies at the CSN College of Further Education in Cork. And he joins me now. Good morning, Shane.
Morning, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well and a happy Easter to you. Why were eggs so popular at Easter?
Oh, my goodness, Marty, we'll have a whole programme on this if I had time. But listen, what's amazing is that we first have to think that eggs were the main source of protein in Ireland throughout the 19th century and right into the early 20th century, you could say, before the industrialisation of food. Because, you know, meat was a major luxury, but eggs were available all of the time and people ate them in abundance. What happens, of course, is that during Lent, people were prohibited from eating any animal produce, which included eggs, of course. And therefore, you had to use up your egg stocks. As we know, Pancake Tuesday, we all have loads of pancakes using up all the eggs. And of course, the hens didn't know that it was Lent. Of course, they kept laying, right?
Yes, of course.
So what happens is you had a glut of eggs building up right throughout the Lenten period. Now, people did all sorts of wonderful things to preserve their eggs during that time. Because the eggshell is porous, to keep it fresh, people used to rub it with butter in particular. So the eggs took on this lovely shiny glow and everyone was looking at them right throughout the Lenten period. And then, of course, when Easter Sunday comes, as in tomorrow, there was a massive egg feast. There was a huge sort of idea to kind of eat as many eggs as you possibly could. And both young and old looked forward to that tradition massively.
And was this what was called a cludog?
Yeah, the cludog is mainly associated with children. Like, we think of children now getting excited with their Easter eggs, which of course is natural enough, and we all think of that. But the cludog was sort of an idea that, say, children went around, particularly today now, Easter Saturday, would be knocking on the doors. They might have a favour sort of promised to them by maybe a banantee somewhere who would, and they'd say to them, you know, my cludog, I'm coming in to claim it at this point in time. And they'd go around, Marty, with a big old sock or maybe a hat or even one of the special beautiful egg baskets, the flat bottom baskets, so the basket would never turn over. But they would, the cludog then was also a sort of a party that they had. And they would find maybe the corner of the farmyard and they would light a fire, usually under the care maybe of a bigger brother or sister. And the cludog, and sometimes it was known as the procog or the playdog, there's different names right throughout the country, but this was the children's feast, if you like, their egg feast. And you know, there were lots of other dainties there as well, bread and butter and cakes and bits of sweets and so on, but eating as many eggs as you could was absolutely brilliant. And one of the lovely things about them is that they sometimes had a pot of boiling water and they'd boil the eggs, but quite often, because they were quite used to it way back now in the 19th century, they would simply pull out the grease, pull out the all hot embers, and they'd roast the eggs and they'd take them up then. And one of the occupations, again, I keep on thinking today is Easter Saturday, so I'm thinking of one of the occupations was making a special spoon for eating their eggs. And these were known as cranchkeens or shishogs. These were little bits of wood that had been fashioned maybe with a penknife. So young boys and girls would be making their egg spoons today for their big, big egg feast, you know.
And Shane, is there a record of who ate the most eggs by any chance?
There is. Listen, do you know, people were eating eggs. I mean, fellas afterwards would be saying, how many eggs did you eat? Did you have, some fellas said, I had six and I had eight, I had a dozen. You know, I think it was the great Tom Minnelli, the great folklore collector collecting from Junior Cree.
And I remember Tom, yeah.
Yeah, the fiddle player out in Bonneville. And what was interesting was that he I think Junior said he'd want to keep a wide berth from a fella after eating a dozen eggs. He said you'd want a gas mask on afterwards. But I did come across an amazing account of a woman in the folklore collection. She was from Coracluny in Tipperary, Nori Noonan, a woman who lived well into her 90s. But she was famous because she had 21 hen's eggs and one goose egg. And forevermore, before she was known in the locality for a woman who ate so many, you know.
Oh my God. Just funny you mentioned Tom Munley and John Junior Creehan, because I knew both of them actually. I work with Tom Creehan, Tom Munley's wife, and Junior Creehan was from my parish. But anyway, tomorrow is Easter Sunday, and there were particular rituals around what eggs you'd eat on that day, wasn't there?
Yeah. Well, you know, the people were collecting eggs and the kids were collecting for their cladog and all of that sort of idea. But there was a particular reverence given to the eggs that were had been laid on Good Friday. And the Good Friday egg would be marked out, specially, actually it would be literally marked. They would take the egg, they would take a little stick and put it, the sign of the cross in it. And that egg then would never be sold. That was the first thing. If you sold the Good Friday eggs, you were mean to the last. Right. But importantly, that egg had never had a best before date. It was thought never to go off, okay? Right. And then in addition to that, it had a cure. If you had a headache or if you had a pain or an ache or anything like that, that egg would be rubbed or would be consumed or whatever. But the whole family then would gather around and they would eat on Easter Sunday morning as many of those eggs as they had that had been laid on Good Friday. But in particular then, even if only one egg was laid, they would actually divide it out amongst the family because they felt that health would follow from there on in. So there was huge traditions around the Good Friday eggs. Also, people would love when they had a clocking hen, a hatching hen, they'd put down maybe 13 eggs, 12 for the 12 apostles and for Christ, and to make sure at least if one egg didn't come right, what would happen then is, of course, you'd have a guaranteed dozen. So there was this sense of the Good Friday being the time of the death of Christ and then the resurrection and everything positive coming from that.
Well, to be honest with you, Shane, I have an egg most mornings, but now that you've taught me all of this, I'll have a whole new perspective on my boiled egg tomorrow morning. Shane Lahan, thank you so much indeed.
Thanks, Brian.
Well, tomorrow it will all be about the chocolate. And for Irish consumers, chocolate is not just for Easter. Chocolate sales in Ireland are booming. And demand for Irish-made artisan chocolate is also on the increase. Suzanne Campbell caught up with some Irish chocolate makers to talk about business during the pandemic and how sales are doing.
Yes, Marty, I mean, sales are better than ever, you know. And I suppose years ago in Ireland, we had a few big Irish chocolate brands like Lily O'Brien's and Lear Chocolates, but there's now actually 35 makers of Irish chocolate and artisan chocolate in the country who are making handmade chocolate, predominantly with better quality and more of it. You know, when we talk about chocolate, if you look at kind of cheap chocolate that we all buy in the supermarket, a lot of it has changed in recent years, and it's got a higher proportion of palm oil that gives a kind of cloying taste. And the reason for that is because chocolate powder worldwide got really, really expensive. So chocolate bars got smaller, the palm oil constituent got bigger, and a lot of people are moving away from commercial cheaper chocolate to better quality chocolate. And of course, there are Irish suppliers benefiting from this. Gráinne Mullins from Galway is one of the chocolate suppliers and chocolate makers new to the business. Now, she worked for over 10 years in fine dining in Michelin star restaurants as a pastry chef, and she has gone just brilliantly from being employed this time last year to now hiring 5 people in her chocolate factory near Gort in Galway, making her brand, which is called Grow Chocolates.
This time last year, I was left jobless and I had way too much free time in my hands. So I decided to make hand-painted Easter eggs for my friends and family, posted them on my own social media, and people were reaching out trying to buy them. And obviously I couldn't at that stage. So I kind of put my thinking cap on. My mum actually encouraged me to maybe start doing a business plan to see, could this be a potential business for me? But as my business plan started advancing, I started thinking this could be a really great opportunity. And within 3 months of idea to launch, I had Grow Chocolates launched as an online e-commerce chocolate store.
That's fabulous progress. You had been a pastry chef before.
Yes, so I've worked over 10 years in fine dining and Michelin star restaurants. I've worked with some amazing chefs and I've learned so much over the years. So I've been very, very lucky to like build on my skills. And I think this kind of helps me to take chocolate at a different angle and trying to make it really creative, lots of different textures, lots of different flavors coming through. And I'm also very lucky that I have a lot of contacts with some amazing Irish producers that make amazing Irish ingredients. So I'm trying to incorporate that in as much as possible, give something very unique and full of fun and color as well, because the chocolates are all hand painted.
Now, I'm talking to you, obviously, in Easter week. Has it been absolutely crazy for you? And has that been a great thing?
Yeah, it's been absolutely crazy. Since Christmas, I suppose we went Christmas straight into Valentine's, straight into Mother's Day, and now Easter. In the last month preparing for Easter, we used 1 ton of chocolate. Yeah, it's a lot of chocolate.
Wow, that's great, though. I mean, I see your brand on social media. I see chefs talking about it. It seems to be hugely in demand, and it obviously is.
Yeah, the demand has been crazy and the support of people has been phenomenal. It's really nice because we don't get to meet our customers. It's all online, but we're starting to get to know our customers through them ordering, and some of them are coming back once a month. It's really fulfilling to see people coming back and enjoying it so much and telling us how much they love it, how the customer service was. That's all really, really important to us. So getting any of that feedback, it just makes our day, and we all share it throughout our group so that everyone gets the boost, from the people that are making the chocolate to packing the chocolate to people that are replying. So it's about, yeah, creating a bit of niceness, I suppose, within it all.
Another chocolate company, a much more long-standing business, which is also experiencing a very good year, is Wild Chocolate in East Clare. Wild was set up by Trish Farrell and her husband, Con, when they moved from Dublin to Clare in the 1990s. And they set up the business in 1997, so I suppose nearly 25 years old. They worked in tourism first. They moved into selling chocolate for tourists and then into chocolate sort of production in a mainstream way, making a factory in the small village of Toome Greeny, on the shores of Lough Derg. When the pandemic came last March, you know, Trish really feared the worst for their business. But online sales, again, just like Grainne's business, really took off, predominantly from Irish customers, and they've made Wild Chocolates as well incredibly busy sales wise.
It has been mental. I thought that the first Easter during lockdown was mental. We had hundreds of eggs in boxes waiting for people to order. And then obviously the country closed and we thought, oh my God, what am I going to do with all these chocolate eggs? We closed the factory and everything, so we did not know what was going to happen. And the phone started ringing and people saying, oh, I still need to order eggs. And then, you know, we put a few on our little website, which was, you know, just a nice little tippy away website. And suddenly that just exploded and we were like in a panic trying to get in brown cardboard boxes because we'd never had the need to order boxes to put stuff into to send them out. So I thought that this year would be a bit more relaxed and kind of take it easy-ish. But no, it was exactly the same as last year. The internet has been completely mad, and it's thanks to the Irish people that they've just said, we're going to buy Irish, we're going to buy local, we're going to buy from small family businesses, you know, and why shouldn't we? And I know our product's probably a little bit more expensive than others because it's all handmade, but they have not quibbled. They just said, no, sure, look at what's an extra euro. It's nothing. The resistance is non-existent now. And they want quality as well. I think that's another thing we've forgotten is that while we might think that we can go back to what we were like 30 years ago, just eating Cadbury's, we can't. Our palates, the Irish palate, has been developing over the last 2-3 decades. We want our nice things. We want quality. We want our gorgeous wine. We want our fantastically handmade chockies. We want them to look beautiful. And so we're going to pay for it. And that's what they've been doing. There is a pandemic silver lining, and don't forget about that. So, you know, challenges produce opportunities. So, yeah, it's been fantastic, I have to say.
So it appears, Marty, as you can hear there, that we have become a complete nation of chocolate guzzlers, especially during this pandemic. And the funny thing is that there's been huge disruption to sales, if you like. The lockdown last year came just before Mother's Day and Easter. Duty free, where a lot of chocolate is sold, wasn't happening. Sales in garages of confectionery fell because there was less people on the road. But then chocolate sales were growing both online and also in supermarkets, where we are buying both cheap chocolate and also premium grade chocolate. I asked Board B's Margaret McCarthy to explain our increasing love of chocolate.
Irish people are eating more chocolate. Actually, in recent years, possibly the volume is maybe declining a little bit, but people are trading up and spending more money on their chocolate. They're becoming more discerning chocolatiers, which is really interesting opportunity for the smaller artisan companies.
Why do you think they're eating better chocolates?
Well, I suppose it's general concerns around health, more interest in higher quality, more interest in provenance, sustainability, and possibly the functionality of chocolate as well.
This year, what have sales been like? I know it's been a kind of a funny one for food because some grocery has really, really boomed. Obviously, food service has been hit very hard because restaurants are closed How have chocolates fared?
Well, if you look at the grocery sales in Ireland for last year, grocery jumped 16% in value last year to about 13 billion euros. Of that, chocolate would have accounted for 400 million, and that actually outperformed the market. So it grew by about 20% in the year. So 60 million jump in chocolate sales in Irish retail last year.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So if you consider that a lot of chocolate would be consumed on the move, so people might go and buy fuel for the car or the newspaper and pick up a bar of chocolate and eat it on the move, that was really disrupted last year and continues to be disrupted. And of course, people are now buying their chocolate through the main multiples and through the main retailers.
Maybe we bought so much chocolate because the kids were home from school. That's what I'm beginning to
think. You know, like chocolate is an indulgence and it's a way people rewarding themselves, you know, it's associated with comfort and it can offer us a bit of escapism as well in the times we're in, that for maybe it's played a role in that.
I'm sure it has. And Suzanne, I'm fascinated because I'm a bit of a chocolate lover myself, but it's amazing how we're becoming more discerning.
We are. And I think part of it is that people's disenchantment with, I suppose, commercial chocolate bars that we all loved in the 1970s, well, if you're as old as me, and in the 1980s and 1990s, they got smaller in size and they just started to not taste as good. And I suppose we travelled, we ate beautiful chocolate, maybe from Belgium, maybe from Germany. And we sort of, you know, when Irish companies started to produce this chocolate, we said, you know, we'll support them. We'll have a little bit of that. And I suppose as well, the big thing is this year, people got very used to shopping online for all sorts of stuff, for clothes, for shoes, but also for food and also for chocolates.
Indeed. And thank you so much, Suzanne, for giving us all that information this morning. And that was Margaret McCarthy from Borbia ending her report. And thanks to Gráinne Mullins from Grow Chocolates and Trish Farrell from Wild Chocolates in Tuam Greiny in East Clare as well. It's a bit early in the day, I have to say, for chocolate, but that report has me looking forward to some nice chocolate tomorrow on Easter Sunday. Still to come on Countrywide, Brenda meets busy writer Orla McAlinden on the family farm, and we meet the parish priest of Knock in County Mayo.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our Mart price calculator on farmersjournal.ie.
And this is Marty Morrissey with you on this Easter Saturday morning here on Countrywide. You're most welcome. Multi-award-winning author Orla McAlinden has certainly packed a lot into her life so far. Listen to this. A mother to four school-going children, she's also a vet, a qualified secondary school teacher, a writer, a farmer, and a self-confessed fashionista. Orla, originally from Portadown, began writing after the death of her father, John, in 2012. She has written a successful novel, The Flight of the Wrens, and two rural short story collections, Full of Grace and The Accidental Wife. Much of the inspiration for her writing comes from her love of farming and rural life. She now lives in Newbridge in County Kildare with her husband Patrick and their family, and they both work a farm on the Athgarvan Road on the edge of the Curra, beautiful part of the country. Brenda Dunhu went for a walk on the farm.
Hi Brenda, great to see you.
What's going on here?
So we're on our lunch break now from school. One of the boys is just doing a little bit of harrowing for me. Just hurrying up this field, taking out the dead thatch and spreading around all the detritus of the winter and cleaning it up. And we'll get in now in a day or two and give it a good roll now that the land is getting drier, and set it up nicely for summertime grazing.
So your son homeschooling?
Homeschooling, but please God, not for much longer. They are so, so lucky that they're not glued to their screens all day long, because there's plenty of work to be done here, and if they ever tell me that they're bored, I can always find them something to do. My husband and I have been living in Newbridge now for well over 20 years. For more than 10 years, we had our eyes open, waiting, waiting, waiting for a farm to come up, because land doesn't come up that often in this area, and it's like gold dust. Couldn't believe our luck to get this beautiful farm here on the Athgarvan Road. Yeah. It's about 120 acres, I suppose, and we've got a lovely stretch of Liffey riverbank in it. Lovely land in the summer, but in the winter it's very heavy clay. It can be quite wet and mucky, and we're here 5 years, so we're still very much on an apprenticeship level with this land. We're still learning every year. We're getting a better idea of how the farm works and how it functions and what's the best way to utilise it, to rest it. The farm is really coming together.
I see how at ease you are here in the farm. And I'm just wondering, how did you get from veterinary college to farming to becoming an author?
Well, the writing came quite late, by modern standards anyway. I was well into my 30s. And unfortunately what happened was my father died unexpectedly when my children were quite young. And I wanted them to know him. And I just started writing a few little family stories. I wanted them to hear his voice and to know his dialect and the way he spoke. So it was a great character, fantastic turn of phrase. And then the stories developed into work that I wanted to share, but I didn't want it to be about my family, so I had to invent a whole new farming community, and that's the genesis of the writing.
There's a great smell of the farm anyway.
Well, my husband is obsessed with grassland management and he's obsessed with silage, and we do make very nice silage here. It's very...
What's nice about silage?
What's nice about silage?
Yeah.
Oh, look, this silage here that our small calves are eating, you could put that in a salad and pour a bit of Hellmann's over it. It's beautiful and dry. Smell that now. You're not convinced, Brenda. In the olden days when people talked about silage, you'd pick it up and you could literally squeeze water out of it, you know. But we're very fussy. What we feed to our calves, other people would be given to their racehorses.
Tell me about some of those sayings or phrases that you wanted to capture in your book and pass on.
When I started writing and I started sending the short stories off to magazines and what have you, I didn't have a huge amount of success at the start. Quite often when I would get a story rejected, the word would come back, look, we just don't like the dialogue, it just doesn't seem real to us, you know, people don't speak that way. And I would think to myself, no, what you mean is the people you know who live in Dublin or Cork or wherever don't speak that way, but this is how people speak where I grew up. And then when the book was actually finally published and it was taken on by Libraries Northern Ireland, and they created a big public reading, the book was brought to a huge audience. And what I used to love, absolutely love, at the public meetings that we did is when people would come to me and say, I haven't heard that word since my mother died. I thought my family was the only family that used that expression. And it just really fills me with joy, because Ireland is still a very rural country, you know, and there's still an audience out there that is very greatly underrepresented in current Irish writing.
Okay.
Oh, I'm just putting a head collar on Toto now. Toto needs a little bit of exercise.
Hi, Toto. As in Wizard of Oz?
Yes, the Wizard of Oz, absolutely.
Orla, how do you manage your time? Because you're writing, you're farming, you're being a mother, all of those things.
Yeah, it is busy. But what people don't always understand about writing is that a huge amount of writing doesn't take place at a desk. Like, there are whole weeks go past that I never sit down with a pen and a paper. And a lot of writing goes on in your head. And because farming can be quite repetitive, a physical, manual work that doesn't involve a huge amount of brain power, that's a fantastic opportunity for me to be thinking about characters and working out plots and where we're going next and who wants to do what with whom or to whom. And
so when you're cleaning out the stables here, for example.
Perfect.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely perfect, because it's physical and it's manual and it allows me a chance to turn my brain off. All right, well, Toto's had a long walk there. We won't bore you with the whole half hour of walking Toto around in a circle, so get rid of him.
Okay. Bye, Toto.
Brenda,
thank you.
You could see the state of my house
compared
to the luxury these animals are living in.
So farming and rural life is all over your books and your stories. Would you mind reading me something to demonstrate that, please?
Well, I'll read just a little snippet from a story called The Ruination of McCaffrey, and it's from my first book, The Accidental Wife. The newly built five-span hay shed loomed in the haggard, freshly painted corrugated iron, improbably green against the blue of an August sky. Square golden hay bales filled two spans. The remainder of the shed gaped emptily, a mouth with too few teeth, a pointless, extravagant folly. Two spans had always been enough for the farm. The old shed, creaking in high winds, had always been adequate before this fool's errand of farm expansion. This new barn represented £15,000 of someone else's money, The repayments had barely started. The debt on this shed would live on long after McCaffrey was hoisted shoulder high and then planted deep in the boneyard. 3 days ago, these bales of hay had lain in the already greening meadows, a ton of summer sun, joyous laughter, and long bright evenings encapsulated in each square bundle. But now they were simply fodder, nothing more or less, just dry grass to be mashed by the tongues and guts of bullocks. The massive bales had been stacked in haste and with scant regard for safety. So what? What possible difference did that make now? The worst had already happened. Okay, unhitch that harrow. We need to go home. Brenda, this school lunch break is over and it's time these boys were back in front of their screens.
Well, look, before I let you go, Orla, tell me what writing and farming has brought to your life and what you've learned about yourself.
I've learned a lot of patience because they're both very, very slow professions. You know, you're looking at an animal for 2.5 years before it leaves the farm. You could be looking at a book for 5 years. It took me 4 years to find a publisher for The Flight of the Wren. It was rejected 70 times. So I've learned patience and fortitude and to believe in yourself.
That was Orla McAlinden talking to Brenda Donoghue. Patience, fortitude and belief in yourself. Wise words indeed. OrlaMcAlinden.com. I love the sounds. I was on the farm there with Brenda and Orla for the last 5 or 6 minutes. So thank you for that. Now, across the country, Christian parishes are preparing for the second Easter of the pandemic. Father Richard Gibbons is the parish priest of Knock in County Mayo and rector of the shrine there. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty.
Welcome to Countrywide, Father Richard.
Thank you very much.
Paint me a picture of what Easter has been like in more normal times since you first joined the parish way back, I think it was 2003.
That's right. Well, in normal times, pre-COVID, we would, in Easter weekend, especially if the weather was very, very good, we would have literally thousands of people here right throughout what we call the sacred 3 days, the Triduum, Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and then leading into Easter Sunday. For example, let's say Good Friday, 3 o'clock, where we normally have the Passion of the Christ, would be maybe about 2,000-3,000 people easily attending that ceremony. Mm. And then that would be kind of normal for hovering around 2,000-2,500 people per ceremony that we would have here in the Basilica and in the Shrine.
Amazing crowds. And this year and last, what has it been like?
Yeah, this year, well, now it's as they say, it's a different country. Just no one. Mm. We would have our local parish community that would be doing their 5K in around the shrine, of course. But we can't have anybody at our ceremonies, which is a massive, it really is a massive loss to us. It's not the same thing. It's as you can well imagine, you know, it's just not, like you can imagine now with GA games, Marty. Mm. It's just not the same without crowds. The atmosphere is different, and you just need it's the sense of community that you're missing. Mm. And we miss it very, very much. And we're just looking forward to getting back to some semblance of normality.
Now, Pope Francis visited Knock in 2018. And that really, if memory serves me correctly, really sowed the seeds for the success of your online presence, which seems to be quite strong.
Yeah, it's our online has been enormous. It even took us by surprise during the course of the last year. Pope Francis came in 2018 in August as part of the World Meeting of Families, and that brought a kind of a different connectivity with people right around the world. Some wouldn't have known about Knock or heard about Knock, but then they became interested. But when we went online for our ceremonies and masses for the pandemic, throughout the pandemic, our people joining us from all over the world it's been fascinating. Like I often say, we get emails from all over the place, like from Ho Chi Minh City to Anchorage in Alaska to Melbourne in Australia, right across South America, anywhere at all that there is, mostly though from the Irish diaspora abroad. But it's been phenomenal.
I saw somewhere, I think it was online, in fact, that you had a kind of a parish hero to be honoured by
Knock? Yes, that's right. We did. We came up with this because we felt, you heard it throughout the country, it was only supposed to be for Ireland, really. People that have been very encouraging of their own parish community and try to keep people connected to the church and are doing, you know, so many unrecognised heroic things on the ground. And they don't want recognition for them. We know that people that were nominated didn't want any recognition whatsoever. But we felt this is a good thing. It's good to acknowledge good being done. So we came up with this idea of a local parish hero that would be sponsored by Knock, and we asked people, look, if you know somebody within your parish, you're within your community, write into us. They might like a little surprise. It'll come out of the blue. They won't know that they're nominated, and tell us their story. And it was a wonderful success. We had five winners in Ireland, one for each of the provinces, really. And then one for Knock itself, Knock Parish. And then because we got a lot of interest from around the world, we decided, okay, all right, let's open it up to the world as well. And the winner in the world, if you like, came from Australia. Parish in New South Wales in Australia, and they hadn't a clue. And we sent out, we had a plaque produced and sent our congratulations, and did that as part of our carol service last Christmas. And it was a wonderful, wonderful success. You know, people really appreciated it.
Absolutely. Now, as well as your global work, and it's great to hear Knock getting onto that international stage, you still have to help out in your local parish, being the parish priest. So how has that been like for you?
Yeah, Knock is unusual like that, unlike any of the other major shrines, let's say Lourdes or Fatima, which are independent of their parishes. But because the apparition took place at the parish church, Knock is also the rector of the shrine is also the parish priest. Well, in fact, he's the parish priest before he's the rector of the shrine. So you have two hats. So I have a parish to look after. It's a small rural parish, but it's wonderful. You couldn't actually really do your job as rector without having that dimension, because it keeps you rooted. People keep you very rooted. You don't lose the run of yourself. You take advice. You get things right. Sometimes you get things wrong, and all of this kind of thing. So, but the people are very, very good, and they support you and they back you up, and they tell you where you might be going astray as well. You know, so like there's that rootedness and connectedness that any priest needs, really.
I don't think there's any fear of you getting big-headed, or because you're well grounded. Let's say good morning to your mother, Mary, because she's in a nursing home there in Knock, isn't she beside you?
That's right, she is. Thank you very much, Mark. Oh my gosh, that will make her, bar me going, in fact, me going in wouldn't even have hold a candle to this now, Marty. She'll absolutely love that.
Well, good morning, Mary.
So she's in the Claremont Nursing Home here, wonderful nursing home, great staff, and she's in great form.
And good to hear that. I'm just thinking, because, you know, when you wanted to become a priest, was she surprised? Because I think you were going off on a different career path.
Yes, I was going towards the law. I studied law, and I was an apprentice in Dublin, and my father kind of got more of a jolt than my mother. My mother kind of would have, she'd be a little bit more perceptive about those kind of things of what might be going on with you, you know. I never came under any pressure, actually, from either mum or dad about it. Dad just wanted me to qualify and make sure that I had something to fall back on in case it didn't work out, and which is very practical.
Stick with your leaving cert and your degree. Yes, I can hear it.
Get the degree.
Yeah.
Get the degree. Whatever you can do else. That again.
Yeah, and do whatever you like after that.
Yeah, that's right. All of that stuff. Well, so, they never put any pressure on me one way or the other, and let me look at if that's what you want to do, absolutely fine with us. And in fact, which was a very good thing, if you go in and find it's not for you, come on back out again, and that's no problem either, you know. Yeah. So it was a very open way of looking at things.
Well, Father Richard Gibbons, I know you're doing great work in Knock, both locally and internationally, and thank you so much for joining us.
Not at all.
On this Easter Saturday. And indeed, RT1 Television is broadcasting the Easter Vigil ceremony from the Basilica at Knock tonight at 11 o'clock. That's all we've time for this morning here in Countrywide. Today's programme was produced by Eileen Herron, Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator, and Mark McGrath was on sound. Coming up after the 9 o'clock news here on Radio 1 is Playback with Sinead Mooney. Thank you so much much for listening. Have a lovely weekend and happy Easter.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our marked price calculator on farmersjournal.ie.